I don't have a slide that says anything about declarations, but I truly affirm that I have no conflicts of interest with regard to any of the things I'm going to talk about, financial or otherwise. Renesia Heal, who was the inspiration for this session, unfortunately is not able to be with us. And I'm going to cover some of this stuff in his presentation in mine. The idea, I think, has become perhaps amply apparent to people in the audience that somehow corporations have to be factored into the equation when we're talking about addictive disorders. It's just not the individual, it's just not genetics, it's just not the environment, it's the way the environment is structured and the products are designed that affect the way that people initiate use of these dangerous consumption products, and it affects the way they develop a neurobiological syndrome that we call dependence or addiction. And with that realization, people like Renesia Heal have begun to conceptualize how corporations who design, who produce, and who market these products can be looked at as part of the causal chain that leads to epidemics of abuse for these products. And I'm going to use alcohol as an example, but you certainly could apply this whole concept very well to gambling behavior, pathological gambling in particular, as well as tobacco use. I think as Natasha Schull's presentation has demonstrated, with many of these products in modern times, the whole equation has changed when transnational corporations have taken over the production and distribution and marketing of these products. We've got much more powerful tobacco products where the nicotine levels could be manipulated. We've got now much more powerful gambling products when they can manipulate the types of games and the reinforcement schedules. And with alcohol, there's been a long history of innovation in product design as well. This comes to a certain extent with globalization of the markets and globalization of the industry. So for alcohol, we have globalization of production, trade, and marketing within the major transnational corporations, the big players, which are now increasingly dominating the world market. And they have been implicated in epidemics of non-communicable diseases, heart disease and cancer, diabetes and others, in part because of the way that these products are designed and the way that they are marketed. So with alcohol, we have Anheuser-Busch, SAB Miller, Heineken, Diageo, these big corporations that have divided up the world and are creating economies of scale by buying up smaller producers and then reinvesting their profits into very sophisticated marketing and product design measures. A lot of these industries have common strategies. Renee Shaheel and I wrote an editorial several years ago that described the common strategies across food and soda and tobacco and alcohol industries. But basically, they use common strategies to increase the availability and the affordability and the attractiveness of their products, and that's certainly true of alcohol. The strategies include aggressive marketing products or campaigns, new product designs, lobbying against evidence-based public health policies, strategic partnerships with non-governmental organizations and with academics, scientific research programs, in terms of sponsoring even health research, but on another level, there's a huge industry of doing research on these products, which is never published in the peer-reviewed journals, to design these products. We learned that with research on nicotine, and now with research on the electronic cigarettes. Promotion of marketing self-regulation to keep statutory regulation out of the policy framework by just taking the responsibility or the irresponsibility of regulating their own marketing activities. And then the larger catch-all term, which is corporate social responsibility projects. So in the field of alcohol, what we've learned is that industry actions can increase alcohol availability. In many cases, these activities are promoted by the industry as ways of contributing to the public health social responsibility of the corporations. But, you know, their marketing activities have drink responsibly built into them, but research demonstrates that nobody pays attention to it, and it really doesn't change anybody's behavior. Product design is another feature in alcohol, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Partnerships with public health organizations and non-governmental organizations. Global actions is a new term that has been developed by the major producers, transnational corporations, where they trotted out a set of commitments in October of 2012 in support of WHO's global strategy. Also, lobbying activities, use of legal action, conferences, research, scientific publications, and again, the promotion of self-regulation. I'm going to quickly go through what we know from different forms of research about the analysis of the impact of these different types of strategies and whether or not they are capable of increasing consumption of alcohol. So, for example, with the increased concentration, we've seen a reinvestment of profits in marketing and political influence. And the targeting of the less resourced countries in different parts of the world, which have very, very poor policy frameworks to prevent countries against alcohol epidemics. And the epidemic model that Renee Jaheel has pioneered on a theoretical level is called the epidemiologic cascade. And it takes into account different levels of analysis, starting at the higher level where you have political factors, particularly government and government policies, working sometimes independently, sometimes in interaction. But it's a central feature of this with transnational corporations is that they can go further upstream and influence the regulatory environment to facilitate free operation of their various profit-making schemes. And they do this through a closed, non-transparent corporate decision making process that leads to a set of activities to maximize the profits through creating a favorable business environment to sell these products. And at the lower levels, the companies have found it very advantageous to create what Renee Jaheel calls conduits. This used to be trade associations, but the trade associations have become much more sophisticated in the alcohol industry, dealing with wine, spirits, and with beer products to promote the interest of the local distributors and retailers. But we also have SAPRO's social aspect public relations organizations, which are organizations that are funded by the producers to do various types of lobbying activity and corporate social responsibility activities that make the industry look good, but which also protect the industry's interests. That puts corporate pressure on the environment of the people who are buying the products. The hosts, the retailers, are in a position then to sell more products to individuals through the modified environment created by industry decisions. And that gets us down to the level that public health works with, at least with alcohol, looking at the host and the environment and the agent interaction. But unless we go further upstream, we're not going to be able to deal with these constant advances in the way that these products are designed and the ways that the regulatory environment and the consumption environment is controlled. So what is the evidence that alcohol problems are corporation-induced? Well, we've got evidence and research on improving the product design to make products more drinkable, adding sweeteners to get young, particularly young women, introduced to alcohol products earlier, graduating them from sweetened beverages to sweetened alcohol products. This is all part of a strategy to recruit new consumers. New marketing activities have been introduced, particularly in the developing world, focusing on youth and women. Retail distribution practices that make alcohol more accessible in countries have taken the lead from the U.S., and now alcohol is available at multiple sources, including vending machines and subway stations. New pricing policies that look at minimum prices for alcohol, selling it as a loss leader to get more people introduced to the product, and influences on the political process itself. What we have are several examples of alcohol industry activities seemingly being connected with the development of epidemics of binge drinking. In Finland, the alcohol industry put pressures on the government through partnerships and lobbying to remove or diminish what was at one time very good alcohol control policies, higher prices, strict controls on availability, and a variety of other factors that really kept Finland as a low consumption country. By putting pressures on the European Union and on the Finnish government itself, there was a dramatic cut in prices via the taxes that led to, within a year, a 9% increase in consumption, which was directly connected with the lowering of prices. And that was soon followed by alcohol-related problems that became the most common cause of death among Finns of working age. Another example is what's happened in the last 20 years or 15 years in the United Kingdom through their liberalization of alcohol control policies. There's been a tremendous amount of lobbying and partnerships with the UK government and the alcohol industry to deregulate alcohol, make it more available in supermarkets, less more affordable in on-premise and off-premise purchase environments, and increases in marketing, and increases in liquor licenses and supermarket sales. With the changes in these zoning policies, we have late-night entertainment districts where vertical pubs have been established right next to the traditional pubs, which are being driven out of business, and they're basically designed to serve high volumes of alcohol to young people. And what you have is an epidemic of public intoxication on the streets of most UK cities. simultaneously with these developments or in alcohol policy, you have very significant changes in hazardous drinking, harmful drinking, and the number of people with alcohol dependence. We have an epidemic of liver cirrhosis in young women in Scotland, which are seemingly highly correlated with these changes in policy. So what is the advantage of looking at alcohol problems, and for that matter, these other epidemics of dangerous consumption products as corporate-induced or corporate-born diseases? Well, we know from public health that it really has great advantages when we start looking upstream for the factors that are pushing people into the water and requiring people downstream to pull them out. And unless we focus on the upstream policy framework, which has to include the alcohol industry, tobacco industry, and gambling industry, we're not going to have much effect on incidence and prevalence. And for alcohol, at least, the best buys, the interventions that have been supported by significant amounts of research have been the upstream interventions, regulating the physical availability of alcohol, pricing and taxation policies, regulating alcohol promotion, drink driving countermeasures. These are a lot less expensive and a lot more effective than treatment and early intervention or training bar owners to cut people off after 15 drinks. And they certainly far outweigh the most popular measures, which are alcohol education in schools, which have not been found to be very effective through randomized clinical trials. So downstream measures really don't have much of an impact. What we really need is, if we're going to have an impact on prevalence rates of alcohol problems, is upstream measures. There are implications for this theory of corporation-induced illness for research as well. Research needs to apply new qualitative methods and quasi-experimental designs to the analysis of corporate strategies. But at least it starts us to focus on the elephant in the room that has been ignored both by the NIH and by the foundations that tend to fund research on addictive disorders. We need to do more surveillance of corporate social responsibility activities and monitor compliance with self-regulation. Examples of ways of doing this can be seen in some of the reaction that people in the public health community had recently to the global alcohol producers' commitments that I mentioned. And their commitments were to sponsor a lot of programs around the world, which are numbering now in over 3,000 programs, that are designed to reduce underage alcohol use, strengthen self-regulation marketing codes, reduce driving under the influence of alcohol, act responsibly in product innovation, and encourage retailers to reduce harmful drinking. Now, this sounds great. Wow, if the industry could finally mobilize itself to deal with drunk driving and underage drinking, we could really have a public health impact. But when you look at these specific things that they have initiated and which they're doing around the world, we took a sample of them and just began to analyze them for the World Health Organization. These are ostensibly being promoted in support of the WHO global strategy to reduce the harmful effects of alcohol, when in fact only 7.5% could be considered evidence-based at all. Most of them are training programs for their own personnel, media campaigns to promote responsible drinking or safe driving, which have been found in most research to be totally ineffective, or other activities that have not been evaluated. Giving, you know, coffee on New Year's Eve to people who are drunk is not an effective strategy to reduce drunk driving, nor are the designated driver programs. In fact, we found in this pilot study that we did of the industry initiatives that 39.5 were considered to have the potential to promote a brand or product, because what was being cited as a contribution to the responsible corporate behavior was actually promoting the brand name at concerts and on advertisements for in some cases, advertisements that violated the company's own self-regulation code. And we found 50% of this sample that we did a content analysis of were considered to pose a potential for risk of harm. For example, in one project they had, they were inviting secondary school graduates in Slovenia to a wine tasting party where they would get a little bit of advice about sensible drinking. But they were introducing the kids as they were graduating to the benefits of drinking wine as well. So these kinds of activities are not designed by public health people. They have no evidence base, yet they're being promoted internationally. And by monitoring this kind of activity, we're in a position, I think, to begin to build a case that conceivably we can do a better job of getting corporations to act responsibly. We did a beer ad study of the games that were played during a 10-year period in the United States, the NCAA men's and women's basketball tournament. We found that depending on the version of the self-regulation code that is used to regulate all TV advertisements for beer, that between 74% and 35% of the ads had some form of a violation. And the ads that were considered to be in violation were not trivial. They were ads associating beer drinking with social success, or ads that were interpreted by expert judges to be appealing to people under the age of 21. So the self-regulation codes don't seem to be working, and this is another area of work where we can begin to apply social science techniques to look at industry behavior. In closing, I think we need to start looking at the implications of corporate-borne disease as well for public health policy. And here, there's an emerging view that in order to reverse epidemics, at least of dangerous products that are addictive, as well as dealing with polio and malaria and other diseases, that the way that public health works best is when it operates at an international level through global health policy networks. And these are organizations working on a global level but sharing a concern for a particular issue. And these networks include scientists and health professionals and policymakers and victim groups and survivors and NGOs and faith groups, et cetera. So we need to start designing, I believe, a counterforce that might be capable of promoting the policies that I think would be capable of limiting dangerous consumption industries. We need to build a stronger health policy network, find financial support for it, frame the issues better, and build a broader coalition. These are some websites where you can get further information, And if you want to write to me, I'd be happy to as well introduce you to Renee Jaheel's study of corporate-induced diseases. And I'm going to find that website in a minute.